Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Well, we're very happy to have Philip and Tanya here. Tanya especially, because we haven't seen you in a while.
Yeah.
Glad to have
you
here.
Thanks for having me.
So do we actually want to talk about A Million Little Pieces?
I do want to talk about it.
Okay.
I really
good.
Do.
I'd like to talk about a couple of the pieces.
at least a couple of 100,000 of the pieces. If I can't believe there's anybody who hasn't heard about this, but there has been now some controversy raging for at least a couple of weeks about this book. It was a very popular book. It was endorsed by Oprah Winfrey, and it was promoted as a memoir. And then it turned out that some of the most significant events in the book that the author relates, some of the most dramatic stuff, he made up. It was not true. And interestingly enough, I think one of the things that I read about the book was that after he wrote the book and was trying to get someone to publish it, he actually initially offered it as a novel.
That's right.
And nobody was interested. They wouldn't buy it until it became a memoir.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then suddenly it was like that. And Oprah, it's one of those kind of books that's about people overcoming great personal adversity. And she seems to like that kind of narrative. So she said, good book, put her stamp of approval on it. And then it turned out that a lot of what's in the book is just made up. And he had to apologize for this. And the publisher had to apologize. And what's interesting is that it says something about this sort of shady territory between truth and fiction.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think I actually recommended that book. It's possible I recommended it on the air years and years ago when it first came out in hardcover. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I really enjoyed it. And when she picked it, I was stunned because I just didn't think that it was a good book for her audience. It was really brutal, really brutal book. Yeah. Lot of violence, lot of hard stuff to take. And I know that she does recommend books like that, but especially since it was a memoir, I mean, there's a lot of drug abuse in this book. And I just was kind of surprised that she picked it in the first place. But I thought, well, that's good, you know, I mean, because I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when this all came out, I started to ask myself, like, well, what makes a memoir? And that's why I was asking Philip, because he might know a little more than me about that. What does make a memoir? I mean, you have to – creative nonfiction is a tricky thing.
Yeah.
And Philip said, when you know you're lying
– then it's a lie.
Yeah.
That's it.
You know? So you –
I mean, everybody has like a famous personal story that they trot out at dinner parties, meeting new friends, at family gatherings. Remember when old Uncle Joe did X, right? You know? And if you ever noticed how over the telling of that story over the years, Cousin Eddie gets excised because she was there but she wasn't really important, or it's better if you conflate it to 2 days instead of four.
Absolutely.
And the next thing you know, your great family story is actually become a short story.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens. And so I think sometimes that we create fiction out of our lives without even realizing that we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the case of James Frye, I think you can't really make that argument for turning 3 hours in prison to 3 months in prison.
Yeah,
I think
agree.
That doesn't work.
And so,
but I think the thing is that he never wrote a memoir. He wrote an autobiographical
novel.
He took events of his life and he wrote an autobiographical novel. And then when no one would take it, he decided to call it a memoir. And
they asked him. I heard that the publisher asked him, how about a memoir?
Yeah.
I think we could
sell it
as a memoir.
That's right.
And so can you, you know, fix it up a little bit
and,
you know, make it a little more true? And
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to think that there are probably a dozen or more James Fries out there who haven't been discovered because they haven't been picked by Oprah. Smoking Gun.
Sure.
The website that first outed him hasn't sort of set their sights on him. And I actually, of course, you have to give the real personal responsibility to James Frye for having done what he did. But I primarily, in this whole mess, I blame the publishers.
Because they didn't do their fact-checking.
It's not even a matter of doing their fact-checking. It's that the publishers aren't publishing good books anymore. they are under this. I mean, a lot of books aren't getting published because they're under so much pressure, more pressure I've read recently than movie studios have to make endless profits. Mm-hmm. They're cutting back. They're doing all kinds of things, and they won't publish a book unless they feel as if
it will sell.
They can get something that absolutely sells. Their jobs are on the line. And so what that means is that they're looking for books that will pander to a wide audience's stereotype about a certain subject yeah. or a certain person or something else. And so Fry turning an autobiographical novel into a memoir fits right into that. The same thing with J.T. Leroy, which you haven't mentioned, but this is another writer who – this is another scam, and this came out a couple days before the Fry, and,
yeah.
it got kind of erased because Fry is an Oprah author. But this is a writer who doesn't exist. He's actually the product of a 40-year-old woman who couldn't get her fiction published, and so she invented not only a pseudonym, but she invented a character to go with it, a 20-something young man who'd been sexually abused, who was a former drug addict and homeless person and so on and so forth, and she got her partners, her husband slash partner's half sister, to impersonate this made up character.
So the author actually made appearances.
Yes, yes.
So they actually had a person.
Yeah, they had a person
right.
that was
playing that
yes,
part.
Exactly.
But that was just someone who was
that was just
right.
someone
playing.
Who had been playing it, and they scammed everybody. They were rock stars and Hollywood stars who just fell for this. And again, it was the kind of thing that panders to a stereotype. You know, it was the homeless drug addict.
Yeah.
You know, kind of Oprah-ish.
We had a cult fiction reading group at the bookstore, and they were always reading J.T. Leroy.
Yeah. And again, though it was presented as fiction, the only reason why people were reading it is because it was supposedly so highly autobiographical that it might as well have been nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Though the fiction of the nonfiction is that it was absolutely fiction. There was no such person. So, but again, both these authors, the 40-year-old woman whose name I'm sorry I can't remember, and James Fry were pandering to publishers who are narrowing and ever narrowing what they deem saleable and publishable, and there are a lot of desperate writers out there who are very good writers who want to get published, who will do anything in order to do it, including living a lie. And I'm sure there are lots of other people out there who are currently sweating bricks because they're afraid that the lie that they're living is going to get out.
Is going to get out.
But it's
now,
the publishers who put the pressure on the agents. The agents put the pressures on the authors, and everybody has done a disservice.
I
think it's just a disgrace all the way around.
I agree. There's this one really significant part in A Million Little Pieces that apparently was, and I don't know exactly what his response about it was because I didn't see the big confrontation or whatever, but I read about it, and he had this dental work. It's a big chapter.
Oh, don't tell me about dental work.
Yeah, there's a big chapter in the book that's probably one of the most gruesome elements, and that just left me. I mean, I had to put the thing down for a few minutes, and and it turns out that was fabricated as well. So. Yeah,
the punishment is he should go through that dental
procedure. Ooh, you are cruel. You are a cruel and hard man. Well, I think there's some very interesting issues. And actually, later in the week, on Thursday, we are talking with a guy who is the director of the nonfiction writing program at Iowa.
Robin Hemley,
who is going to be here. And maybe we'll also talk about some of those sorts of things. Because he has written a novel. He's written fiction, but he's also written nonfiction.
Wonderful nonfiction.
And
I
think it'd be interesting to talk with him about some of these same things about, you know, where is that line?
And what is emotional truth?
Yeah.
What's the difference between emotional truth? I mean, how much can you, when you're writing nonfiction, I mean.
I've written a memoir. I co-wrote it with my wife, Parallel Worlds, a memoir about our experiences in Africa. But we had so much evidence to rely on. We had thousands of pages of fieldwork notes that my wife Alma had written. I had written hundreds and hundreds of letters that I'd kept copies of, you know, And we had photographs, we had day books, we had everything. There was almost no hour of the day that wasn't accounted for
right.
in some way. And so we could always use that. And sometimes I would find that I would write from memory a scene first, and then I would go back and look at the evidence we'd accumulated, like a photograph of an event or something, and then I had absolutely gotten it wrong.
It wasn't how you remembered
it. It wasn't at all how I remembered it. And mm-hmm. I had to change it, you know. I felt I really had to change it. And it wasn't like it was a terrible thing to have done that. It's just that memory is a deeply slippery thing.
Yes, that's the thing.
There's the thing. And so I think the question comes in, are you a victim of your slippery memory, or have you greased your memory to be extra slippery? Mm. And I think that's where intent comes in. You know, I think we can all say, sure, we got something wrong or whatever. You know, I mean, that's just how it happens with
right.
memory. But if you consciously try to say, I'm going to alter this because I think this is going to be a better thing, and then pretend that you haven't, well, then
right.
the pretense makes it no longer nonfiction.
Yes,
and clearly
yeah.
it seems that that's what James Frey did.
Oh, absolutely.
I think
he
admitted as much in a recent story I read. He essentially said, well, you know, I thought by doing the things that I did, it would make mm-hmm. a better story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the
right,
old,
yes.
you know, the old cliche about don't
yeah.
let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Of a good story. Yes.
Well,
yeah,
that's what
that's
he
very
did.
Popular
and
these
I
days.
Have to say, I mean, even in the face of all this, I mean, if you want to read that book as a novel, I mean, it's yeah. a very good read. It really is. I really enjoyed yeah. it. And the style is hard to get at first yeah. because it's written like a, you know, like a crack addict. but
yeah. So yeah. now as a result of this, will no one want to have anything to do with him, or is this actually does this work for him?
I think this works for him because I think that his books, no matter what he does now, I think that people will want to read it. I really do. I really do.
I have read a recent article that said that he's dead to people in Hollywood, so I think he's lost some.
The sequel's on the New York Times right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, our guest this morning here in this part of Focus 580, Philip Graham. He's professor of English at University of Illinois and writer. And Tanya Liasakis is on staff of Pages for All Ages Bookstore. And every once in a while, they're here on the program. And we talk about new books. They always bring things that they have discovered. And as I said at the beginning of the program, I've gotten some good suggestions. I have read some of the books that they have mentioned, and I'm sure there are people listening have done the same, and that they're waiting. They're waiting to hear about some of the things that you've been reading. And let me also mention, too, that we will have the titles of the books on our website so that you don't need to madly be trying to scribble these things down. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have Internet access, then we can send you a list.
Okay.
No, I think Philip would like Tanya to go first.
Okay.
Yeah. Welcome
back. Thank you. I would like to recommend a young adult novel, which I read a lot of, called A Mango-Shaped Space by Wendy Mass. And it's about a young woman with an interesting problem. I don't know if you want to call it a problem. I'm not going to tell you what it is yet. I'm just going to read you the prologue, and you'll see what her issue is. Freak. I'll never forget the first time I heard the word that day at the blackboard. It was 5 years ago when I was 8. For those who are mathematically challenged like me, that means I'm 13 now. So there I was, dressed in my shepherd girl costume for the Christmas play after school, struggling to complete the math problem on the board while my fellow third graders watched. The one-size-fits-all costume didn't fit me, the shortest shepherd in the class, so I had to keep pushing up the sleeves. The chalk dust tickled my nose. My feet were freezing in the sandals that, in my humble opinion, no one should have to wear in northern Illinois in the middle of December. My mission was to multiply 24 times 9. I remember thinking that if I wrote slowly enough, the bell might ring before I could finish. Just 5 more minutes. Then no one would know that I couldn't solve the problem. I rolled the smooth piece of chalk around my fingers and tried not to think about the whole class staring at my back. Glancing around in what I hoped looked like intense concentration, I noticed a few fragments of colored chalk on the ledge of the board. To use up some time, I put down the white piece and began rewriting each number on the board in its correct color. Mia! My teacher, Mrs. Lowe, startled me. As I turned, the chalk screeched on the board and a deep red zigzag shape sped across my field of vision. My classmates groaned at the noise. "This is an art class," she said, wagging her long skinny finger at me as if I didn't know that. "Just use the white chalk." "But isn't it better to use the right colors?" I asked, confident that the other kids would agree. The class giggled, and I grinned, thinking they were laughing at her, not me. "What do you mean, the right colors?" she asked, sounding genuinely confused and more than a little annoyed. Now I became confused. Wasn't it obvious what I meant? I looked at my classmates for help, but now their expressions had changed. They gawked at me as if I had suddenly sprouted another head. My hands started to shake a little, and I rushed out my explanation. the colors, the numbers, you know, like the two is pink. Well, of course, it's not really this shade of pink, more like cotton candy pink. And the four is this baby blanket blue color. And I just figured it would be easier to do the math problem with the numbers and the correct colors, right? I pleaded with my classmates, my friends, to back me up. This time when the class laughed, it didn't sound so friendly. I felt my cheeks burning. Then I heard it in a loud whisper from the back row. Freak. Except it sounded like freak. What are you talking about, Mia? Demanded my now clearly irate teacher. Numbers don't have colors. They simply have a shape and a numerical value, that's all. But they have all those things, I whispered, my voice sounding far away. Mrs. Lowe put her hands on her hips. I've had enough of this. For the last time, numbers do not have colors. Now are you going to complete the assignment? I stared at her and shook my head. I suddenly felt very small, as if my skin was tightening and I was actually shrinking. A whirring sound filled my head. How was this possible? Was everyone playing a trick on me? Of course numbers had colors. Were they also going to tell me that letters and sounds didn't have colors? That the letter A wasn't yellow like a faded sunflower, and screeching chalk didn't make red, jagged lines in the air? I replaced the chalk on the ledge, aware for the first time that my hands shake when I'm nervous. I stood with my arms at my sides, sleeves hanging halfway to my knees. Was I the only one who lived in a world full of color? I waited to see if they were going to tell me the earth was flat. A badly constructed paper airplane wobbled past my nose. Mrs. Lowe sent me to Principal Dubner's office, where I repeated my explanation for using the colored chalk. By the time my parents arrived an hour later, I'd run out of steam. I sat there and listened to them talk about my uncharacteristic behavior. I wanted to tell the principal that his name was the color of freshly piled hay. I quickly thought better of it. Even at 8 years old, I was smart enough to realize that something was very wrong, and that until I figured out what it was, I'd better not get myself in deeper trouble. So I pretended I made everything up. I sat there and said things like, "It was stupid. I was only playing around." And at least 20 times, "I'm sorry." The principal left me in the hands of my parents, who brought me home. I promptly kicked off the stupid sandals, threw on my sneakers, and took off running through the fields behind my house. The cold didn't bother me. I was too busy brooding over the unfairness of it all. The Christmas play was short, one shepherd girl. Mrs. Lowe made me clean the erasers for a week and apologize in front of the whole class for taking up their time with my nonsense. Those were her words, not mine. Pretty soon, everyone forgot about that day. Everyone but me. I learned to guard my secret well. But now I'm 13. Everything is about to change, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. So, this young woman has something that I believe is a real thing.
Yeah, synesthesia.
Synesthesia. And she associates, you don't know what it is, obviously, associates colors with all kinds of things, days of the week, months, everything has a color, really.
A lot of people who have that.
And what she begins to find, actually, is that, and this is why it's a good young adult book, I mean, besides just being fascinating.
And a great title now.
And a great title.
Mango-shaped space. That's just perfect, yeah.
Is that it's a problem for it first, but of course she finds that this unique thing about her is actually really helpful. And it helps her in school academically, and it helps her deal with the death of her grandfather, and helps her, you know, she finds she's actually a very unique and special person. So, but I love reading about the colors, the things that it almost makes sense, the things that, because I don't have this, I don't associate, although I vaguely associate colors with days of the week. That's the only thing I can, just very, very vaguely, and then not even all the days of the week, but she has it. She really has it. She everything. Your name has a color. My name has a color. Words have colors. Yeah, it's a real thing. So pretty interesting book.
Well, that's remarkable. This is something that I've never heard of.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't think that I have. But the thing that interested me is as you were sitting there reading the passage, Philip had this look on it, this great distress on his face.
Oh, that awful teacher.
I don't know whether he was upset with the teacher.
He
was so bound up in the story of this little girl who doesn't actually
exist. Come in and say, "You stop that. You leave that girl alone."
But they don't know, you know. They've never heard of it either, so. Yeah, synesthesia.
I tell you what, we're getting close to the point here we want to take a break. And we do also have a caller, and she's been waiting for a while. So why don't we talk with her in Aurora? Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
This is my one of my favorite programs that you have on. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I wondered if you could recommend a book that is inspirational, something like Icebound, about the female doctor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And The Water is Wide, about the teacher who taught on an island in South Carolina, I think it was. Do you know of any book like that that you could recommend?
Something nonfiction?
Yeah.
I want a true thing. Okay. There's a memoir by the guy who, I can't remember what it's called, but there's a newish memoir by the guy who cut off his arm when he was mountain climbing.
I don't know if I could read that.
Really?
I mean, he got it caught and he had to free himself.
Exactly.
Exactly.
You don't want that. Okay.
Actually, that's not true. He only had an ingrown fingernail, but then he exaggerated and what?
Laughing at other people's pain. No, that's a very inspirational story there.
Just making a James Fry joke. That's all.
Well, I don't. Maybe this is one of those cases where we need to invite the people who are listening to call in and suggest
something. I'm coming up blanks.
Yeah. If you've stumped these two guys, you've done pretty well.
Yeah.
But I'll
keep thinking.
Yeah. If we come up with something, or if someone listening has a title to mention, they can do that.
Yeah, okay. I find fiction to be inspirational, but I don't read inspirational books.
I don't really read a lot of nonfiction.
Well, I tell you what. Well, let us pause here in our book conversation to encourage people to support the station with their dollars, and in the process, they can get something to read. We're here. This is our winter fundraising effort, and we want to make sure that people listening know that what we're looking for this morning is money to support the programming that you hear on this radio station, WILL. What we want you to do is call us at 244-9455 and make a pledge, which means promise to give us some money. Much of the money that it takes to run this place has to come from listeners. We know that the costs keep going up, and we know, you no doubt know if you've heard us talk about this for I don't know how many years now, that the funding hasn't kept pace, so the only way that we can go to make up a difference is to the listeners. And that's what we're doing here. And we found that this is one of the best ways we can think of, in fact, to reach out to people who have never supported us before. So if you're now a friend, we want to say thanks. And if it's time for you to renew, we want to say, please do that. But if you've never supported the station before, we particularly want to say, please do that. 244-9455 is the number. Now, here in the studio with me is Jack Brighton.
Hello.
Let's make that book offer again.
The book offer. Anybody who pledges at the basic membership level of $40 a year, $25 if you're a senior citizen, student, or on a fixed income, you will get a book from the Focus 580 archive, library, whatever it's called. We have a bunch of books sitting around here. The publishers send us. We're happy to share them with you. All you need to do is make a pledge, 244-9455, and you have a choice of either fiction or nonfiction. And David, you're absolutely right. We have to get support from the people who listen, use the station. It takes a village, as they say. Actually, it takes more than a village. It takes a whole bunch of villages to keep this thing called public radio on the air. That's how we do it. We don't sell airtime to advertisers and bombard you with commercial messages. We bombard you with ideas. We think that's a good thing
to
do.
As shocking and as dangerous as that
That's right. And we like to bombard you with books. So give us a call or a pledge line. I know we have one line active, and there's some other people standing by to answer the other lines. Also standing by is Kimberly Cronick, our outreach coordinator with the volunteers in the phone center. And Kimberly, you do a lot of great work out in the community, involving us in a lot of different projects and so forth. And right now, we need to involve people in paying the bills, of course.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And I'm inspired by the volunteers that are here giving up their time because they support public radio not only financially but with their volunteer commitment. And we've got Sherry and Kathy and Joan on staff here and Liz. They're all here to take your call. Harriet just popped in. The number is 244-9455, and you might be listening online. We do have a lot of online listeners. You can pledge online, WILLpledge.org, WILLpledge.org. We do have a goal. We want to have raised $17,000 by the end of today. We're at $11,300, so we're on our way, and we're waiting for your call. The phone is ringing. That's good news. I want to give a little incentive for those who listen and haven't yet pledged. We're looking for new friends of WILL, and if you can call right now at 217-244-9455. For a $40 pledge, not only will you get, that's our basic membership, but you'll get a book. You'll also get a gift certificate for $10 at the World Harvest Foods in Champaign. They're a great international food market, and they want our listeners to know that they support WILL, and they like you too, and they're offering this extra incentive. So there is a limited number of certificates. So call now, 217-244-9455. Again, basic membership is just $40, $25 if you're a senior, student, or on limited income. And you can bring your credit card, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express. We make it real easy for you to make a pledge right now.
Very easy to do. 244-9455. Make that pledge call. 217 is the area code. If it's a long-distance call, you can make it a collect call because we want to bring you into the family or the friends of WILL, the people who support the station. And a lot of good reasons to support, you know, make that pledge call, including the free book this morning during Focus. But the main reason is to support the service, to keep us on the air. So we hope that you care enough to become an active supporter of the station. 217-244-9455.
Jack, can I ask a couple questions?
Absolutely.
Are all the pages of these free books correctly numbered?
I believe they are, in fact.
Are all the words correctly spelled?
We've actually read every single book that comes through the door,
and
we haven't done that.
Spelled?
What am I saying?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, Martha Deal is in charge of going through every book and checking the spelling.
We measure the edges so they're not true.
This is a very good deal.
Are they all in English?
Well, I don't know. Are they?
I think so.
Yeah, probably.
That's whether they're comprehensible or not is another question. But I think that they are all in English, yes.
That's right.
All right. Well, that's the deal. So we hope that we'd hear from a lot of people here this morning who want to support the station. We've done this program now for quite a few years and keep doing it because it's fun and also because we get response. So that's the deal. We really like to hear from you this morning. Well, I do also have a couple of callers, and I kind of think maybe they may be responding to our call for books suggestions for the first caller that we had. So let's do that. Urbana is line one. Hello.
Hi, we've just finished reading a memoir, Change Me Into Zeus's Daughter, by Barbara Robinette Moss. She grew up in a family where the father was an alcoholic and a World War II vet and determined not to accept charity for his family. But he's always with the family, and at one point it starts out with the mother being reduced to eating seed corn that has poison on it, and she's not sure what's going to happen, so she eats a bit of it first and then waits to see if something's going to happen to her, and with strict instructions to the kids to not eat anything until they see whether she keels over. The author ends up with a deformed face because of malnutrition, and it's quite haunting about what it's like to be really impoverished and have this parent who's unpredictable, are predictable in unpredictable ways. And at the same time, it's just amazing what the kids, ways that the kids manage to turn some things around for themselves. At one point, her mother finds a pair of patent leather shoes for her, used, but they have a hole in the sole. And Barbara's really pleased that she's got some decent-looking shoes, but doesn't want anybody to realize that they've got a hole in the sole, but her arch nemesis discovers this at school and gives her a hard time. And then he drops his dime on the floor, his dime for ice cream, and she's never had a dime for ice cream. And she reaches her shoe over and puts the hole over the dime and then flips it back, and nobody has figured out where the dime has gone. She has a dime for ice cream. it's quite clear that we were reading this in a book group, and somebody said, it's amazing how resilient kids are. And somebody else said, yeah, they're resilient, but there's damage that lasts. She eventually becomes a writer and goes to, I think she must have been at the Iowa University of Iowa Writers Group.
Oh, wow.
And she has a second book. The first book is about her childhood, and the second book is about her adulthood. They're survivor stories, and I strongly recommend them. I was just amazed by them. We've also read The Persian Pickle Club, which is a Depression-era mystery. It doesn't start out as a mystery. It's about a small-town quilting circle in a town in Kansas. And then Take the Cannoli by Sarah Vowell.
Oh, that's a great book.
Which is a whole bunch of quirky thoughts and ramblings. And
yeah, I love Sarah Vowell.
Yeah. And we're currently reading America's Women, 400 Years of Dolls, Drudges, Helpmates, and Heroines. And that's the kind of thing that's so crammed with information, which is very readable, but it's not something that you can... That carries you along, that you discover after half an hour that you're 20 pages into it. Half an hour, and I'm 5 pages into it, making notes and so
my
forth.
Goodness.
So
yeah.
Those are my suggestions.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you. Now we have a number of other people here. Let's go to line number 2. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I am reading a series of books by Harry Kemmelman, K-E-M-E-L-M-A-N. Mm-mm. The woman from Aurora most likely has read this series. I understand at least 3 of them are more, say, realistic than the others. But even the others are mysteries, and of course, but there's a lot of educational information in them. The 9-Mile Walk, Common Sense in Education, I have not read that. Someday the Rabbi, Conversations with Rabbi Small, that one is quite educational, if you can follow all the logic. Then Number Our Days by Barbara Meyerhoff is another possibility.
Yes, that's a very good book. And yes, indeed, it's inspirational.
That was my contribution.
Oh,
thank you.
Bye.
Very good. Let's go again to line number... Let me see. I want to make sure I try and get him in the right order here. To Matt Toon, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to suggest a book that I haven't read, but my wife did and told me about it extensively. It's by Charles Mee, who is described as a playwright and author of more than a dozen books. And it's a memoir, an honest memoir of his life, called A Nearly Normal Life. And as a 14-year-old in the early 50s, he was stricken with polio. And I believe, if I remember right, from my wife, it was as he was either walking to or walking home from the first date that he ever had that he collapsed.
Goodness.
And she just said it was an incredibly moving book and a real-life account of how he struggled through that and how he survived polio and went on with what he did with the rest of his life, which obviously is to become a successful author. And I didn't know if you had heard of that, but it's Charles L. Mee.
No, it sounds very good.
I don't know him.
And it's called A Nearly Normal Life.
Good title.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Very good. All right. Thank you. Well, and let's go one more here. We'll go to line number 3, and this is Champagne. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I have 2 things to recommend. A book, which is Music as Medicine. In hospice, we had our 25th anniversary, and that's a very, very inspiring life of music, healing, and faith. She works with kids with cancer at Cleveland, and it's a paperback. So I recommend that book. And I know all the WILL staff, and you know me. And anyway, all I can say is bravo. I contribute and listen. Thanks.
All right. Well, again, thanks for the call.
Thank
you. And that's a book. It's titled Music as Medicine, and the author is Kay Gardner. I will do one more. This is something that was called in off the air. Someone was suggesting a recent book by Tracy Kidder, a book that's titled Mountains Beyond Mountains.
That's supposed to be fantastic.
I think that Celeste talked with Tracy Kidder about this very book on the Afternoon Magazine.
I heard that.
A man named Paul Farmer, who's a physician, and about his efforts and he's an expert on infectious disease, about his efforts to work with communities in the developing world to try to bring modern medical technology to those folks and make their lives better. So that's yet another suggestion.
Okay, my memory has been jarred by all of these suggestions. I had, I thought, and I think I've recommended this before, but books about overcoming diversity or adversity and dealing with physical trouble too is that book Autobiography of a Face by Lucy Greeley. She's a poet.
Yeah,
that's a wonderful book. Inspirational.
Okay. Well, now that we've worked our way through all those recommendations, we're half an hour into the show. Philip really hasn't recommended a book yet, so go for it.
Maybe I won't. Okay, this is a short novel, by a young writer. He's in his early 20s, Uzo Dinma Iweala. His parents are from Nigeria. He was born in 1982, graduated from Harvard. He's won an enormous number of awards for someone his age. And this first novel comes with a bunch of wonderful blurbs from Francine Prose, Ali Smith, and Salman Rushdie. It's called Beasts of No Nation. And it sort of maybe is a good book to talk about in response to the first book that that Tanya recommended. It's another kind of childhood. And this is a childhood of a young West African boy who has been conscripted into one of the roaming armies in the stateless areas in West Africa that have been filled with wars and endless wars, like Sierra Leone and Liberia and the western part, unfortunately, of Ivory Coast right now. And this young child, in order to survive, becomes a soldier. And he witnesses terrible things. He is forced at first to do terrible things, which then he does almost out of habit. And the novel is told, it's a short novel, about 140 pages long, in his voice, in his child's voice. And this is a boy who, while he's going through these horrible battles and seeing just terrible things, he's remembering what it was like before war. He wanted to become an engineer. He was good at books. He doesn't know where his family is. The soldiers kind of become his family, though at the same time he's sexually abused by the commandant, and people are killed indiscriminately. And he's living a kind of a Hieronymus Bosch existence. And I just want to read a short piece about this young man who's marching with the other soldiers. He's just a child, and he's got he's got a gun on his back as he's walking along in the heat. My sweat is burning my eye away. Now it is so hot because the sun is beating on my back and making my gun to warm so much that it is feeling like hot iron on my back. I know it is making mark and burning my back, so I am like cow and belonging to one owner, which is gun. I am sadding when I am feeling this gun in my back, because I am thinking that first, when this war is starting, I am wanting a gun because I can be using it to protect myself. At this time, gun is belonging to me, and it is going wherever I am carrying it. But now it is just riding on my back like it is king, and I am servant to be doing whatever it says. If it is saying go right, then my body is walking to the right, even if I am struggling to go left. And if it is saying for me to stop, then I am stopping to catch breath. And if I am going down the hill with the other men, then it is saying go faster, and it is pushing me down the hill just like that. I am not liking this at all, and I am wanting to be throwing gun away into the bush. But if I am throwing gun away, then the commandant will be throwing me away, because gun is more important than me. I am always remembering this.
Wow,
and it's powerful. The whole book is like this, and it's a hellish world that this child finds himself in, and he's always worrying about: is he a good boy? Is he a bad boy? Is he going to hell? You know, he went to church, he went to school before his world, his country fell apart, and this voice that really only talks about a large, difficult time in the history of Africa from a one child's point of view says an enormous amount about the cost of these terrible wars. And it's a deeply moving book, and you'd think that considering how difficult some of the material is in this book, that it would be hard to read, you'd want to keep putting it down, but the young child's voice is so mesmerizing, mm-hmm. so mesmerizing that you find yourself so. And even though he's finding himself doing terrible things, you find yourself caring for him so much and wanting to get out of this that you literally cannot put this book down. Almost can read it in one sitting. It's so short. His name again is Uzo Dinma Iweala, a first novel, Beasts of No Nation.
We are getting close to the end of the first hour. Philip and Tanya will be with us for both hours this morning, so I'm sure we'll have time to do some other recommendations. At some point here, we also need to do an emergency alert system test, and I want to. It's something that we need to do. We're required to do, and I, if we don't do it by a certain time, it'll go off by itself.
Do and it
I
now.
Do not want to do it in the middle of you doing a reading. So why don't we do this? This is a test of the emergency alert system.
Instituted by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. This station is participating in a required monthly test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was...
Okay, this is Focus 580 here on AM 580, and we are talking about new books, and our guests are Philip Graham, he's professor of English at University of Illinois, and Tanya Leotsakis from Pages for All Ages Bookstore. It's something we like to do occasionally on the show. It's always a good time for us, and people have told us over the years that they really like the show and like hearing Philip and Tanya and appreciate the recommendations, and that's why we keep asking them back. Tanya.
Okay.
Go ahead.
This is the new Paul Auster novel called Brooklyn Follies. And I love him, actually. He's got a really good voice and always page-turning books. This is about a man who he's developed cancer and he's decided to go to Brooklyn, where he's from, to die. And he really just sort of wants anonymity. He wants to be left alone. He doesn't really have any family left. And so he's just gone there to be by himself. But he, while he's there, runs into this long-lost nephew, Tom, who he used to be very, very close to and lost track of him over the years. And he turns up working in this little bookshop. And the thing about Paul Auster is that all of his characters, I just love his characters. His books are always full of strange and unusual and exciting characters, and he paints them in a way that is that you really feel like they must be real people or that you know someone that's very much like that. I'm always associating his characters with people that I've known in my life. So this is Tom's little story, and I thought Philip actually might like this because he used to drive a taxi, I believe.
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this chapter is called Purgatory. No one grows up thinking his destiny is to become a taxi driver. But in Tom's case, the job had served as a particularly grueling form of penance, a way of mourning the collapse of his most cherished ambitions. It wasn't that he'd ever wanted a great deal from life, but the little he had wanted turned out to have been beyond his grasp. To finish his doctorate, to find a place in some university English department, and then spend the next 40 or 50 years teaching and writing about books. That was all he'd ever aspired to, with a wife thrown into the bargain, maybe, and a kid or two to go along with her. It had never felt like too much to ask for, but after 3 years of struggling to write his dissertation, Tom finally understood that he didn't have it in him to finish. Or if he did have it in him, he couldn't persuade himself to believe in the value of doing it anymore. So he left Ann Arbor and returned to New York, a 28-year-old has-been without a clue as to where he was headed or what turn his life was about to take. At first, the taxi was no more than a temporary solution, a stopgap measure to pay the rent while he looked for something else. He searched for several weeks, but all the teaching jobs in private schools were filled just then, and once he settled into the grind of his 12-hour daily shifts, he found himself less and less motivated to hunt for other work. The temporary began to feel like something permanent. And although a part of Tom knew that he was letting himself go to hell, another part of him thought that perhaps this job would do him some good, that if he paid attention to what he was doing and why he was doing it, the cab would teach him lessons that couldn't be learned anywhere else. It wasn't always clear to him what those lessons were, but as he prowled the avenues in his rattling yellow Dodge from 5 in the afternoon to 5 in the morning, 6 days a week, there was no question that he had learned them well. The disadvantages to the work were so obvious, so omnipresent, so crushing, that unless you found a way to ignore them, you were doomed to a life of bitterness and unending complaint. The long hours, the low pay, the physical dangers, the lack of exercise, those were the bedrock givens, and you could no more think of changing them than you could think of changing the weather. How many times had he heard his mother speak those words to him when he was a boy? "You can't change the weather, Tom," June would say, meaning that some things simply were what they were, and we had no choice but to accept them. Tom understood the principle, But that had never stopped him from cursing the snowstorms and cold winds that blew against his small, shivering body. Now the snow was falling again. His life had been turned into one long battle against the elements, and if there was ever a time to start grumbling about the weather, this was it. But Tom didn't grumble, and Tom didn't feel sorry for himself. He had found a method to atone for his stupidity, and if he could survive the experience without completely losing heart, then perhaps there was some hope for him after all. By sticking with the cab, he wasn't trying to make the best of a bad situation. He was looking for a way to make things happen, and until he understood what those things were, he wouldn't have the right to release himself from his bondage. And he drives a taxi for a while, but then he meets a very interesting man named Harry Brightman, who owns this little bookshop where he ends up working, which is where his uncle Nathan comes and discovers him once again, weighing like 400 pounds, not looking like he once did because of all that time driving a cab. Did you gain any weight driving a taxi?
Actually, no. I was too frightened most of the time. Actually, I did. I gained my weight later, but not as a cab driver. Yeah.
But interesting stories from the cab,
oh,
right?
Oh, my God.
For sure.
My children actually always beg me to tell my cab stories to their friends when they have new friends.
Yeah, yeah.
And things. I've trotted out all my famous cab stories. I was a cab driver in New York City. So
right.
It was a dangerous and exciting job. Let's put it that way.
Yes. Well, this book shows some of that, too. But yeah. The great thing about the book is that the guy that Tom works for, Harry Brightman, turns out to be quite a character. And he's actually he hires people to fabricate. What's the word I'm looking for? To
memoirs?
Do copies of. No, not memoirs. Paintings. Paintings.
Ah, forgery, yeah. I think, is the
forgery.
Word you're looking for.
Thank you. Yes, to forge paintings. And actually, eventually, novels. A Hawthorne novel.
Goodness.
Yeah. So it's kind
you mean
of...
an undiscovered Hawthorne novel.
An undiscovered Hawthorne novel.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Very good. Yeah. Cool. But anyway, he comes to Brooklyn to die and wants to be left alone, but then actually finds... you know, that he has this one family member and gets involved in all of this crazy stuff and decides that he very much wants to live. So
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, during the break, we'll have to get Philip to tell us some
That's right.
cab stories. And then if we can repeat them on the air, maybe we'll ask him to tell them on the air. We're real close to the end of the first hour. I don't, Philip, do you want to go ahead and mention one more thing?
How much time you got for me?
Here comes Jack.
Hardly any time at all.
Let's just, hi, Jack.
Here comes the bad cop.
That's it. Yeah, we set up that relationship with guests, didn't we? Yeah.
Come on, you better make a pledge or I don't know what I'll do. Come on.
Look, my producer's crazy. So you just should go along and be nice and answer my questions because if you don't, you know, I can't be held responsible for what will happen. Worked for us for, I don't know how long, 10, 15 years?
That's right. Philip, if you pledged. No, sorry. 217-244-9455. Let's get that information out there right away. We're looking for your pledge call because we have to keep this radio station going, obviously. And we also want to give away some books. And if you make a pledge call at our basic membership level, $40 a year or $25 if you're a student or senior citizen or on a fixed income, we will send you a new hardcover book from the Focus 580 Library. These are two categories, fiction or nonfiction. You can tell the phone volunteers. Please make that call now, 217-244-9455, and help us support this service and this show and these ideas that we throw at you over the airwaves and so forth, and also get a free book. And actually, if you call right now, David, didn't you say you would personally come over and read the book to the people who make pledges?
That's new.
No. No, I don't think I did.
I must have misunderstood.
Okay. I would be. No. I'm not sure what would concern me most, that no one would want me to or a lot of people would want me to. No, people will have to read them for themselves.
Okay.
I'm sorry. That's a requirement that they indeed have to read
well,
the book.
What kind
themselves.
Of deal is that?
Well, we can't do everything now, Tanya. But we can put the book in your hands. So please make the call right now because you only have until noon and you might as well get it out of the way, right? So 217-244-9455.
Maybe David could massage their feet while they're reading the book themselves.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Well, we'll consider that.
I hope our development staff is not listening to this.
Do you cook, David?
He's an excellent cook. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But first, let's check in with Kimberly Cronick, who's in our Pledge Center, and how we doing on pledges during this book giveaway, Kimberly.
Oh, we're doing really well, but I just have to chime in there, too. Yes. David, how about if you read the book on tape? We have some really good radio studios here. You could record it, and people could listen in their car.
Keep brainstorming. This is good. Yeah. This is good. Okay. Keep the ideas coming. That's good.
Phones are ringing, and that's a good sign. We need to get to $17,000 by the end of today, and we're almost at $12,000. We're at $11,727, so we're getting there. We need your call, 217-244-9455. We've got friendly volunteers. Sherry and Kathy and Liz are here, and Joan and Heather on WILL staff to take your call. And, you know, we're looking for new folks who love this service, listen to it on a daily basis or a weekly basis, and can become a member. $40 is a basic membership. Again, you get a book, but you also get, we can give you a gift certificate at the World Harvest Foods in Champaign. That's a great place to shop. But there are so many reasons, not the thank you gifts, that you listen to our station. These are just extra incentives. We know you like listening to the shows on books. How about finance, auto repair, health? We have great local news. We have voices of youth on the air. We do it all, and we have talk programs, so you're always interacting with us.
That's right.
You know, this is something you don't get anywhere else.
That's
right. Phones are ringing. That's a good sign. You can pledge online, too, willpledge.org. But call right now, and it takes just a few minutes, 217-244-9455.
Absolutely. And we need to keep, you know, more people who have not pledged before. We need to get more people to make that phone call, because we know only about one out of every 10 listeners supports this station. And really, when you think of it, it's just pennies a day. You can become the 2 out of 10 and help us keep the service going and get a book. We keep pushing the books because we really, well, they're actually kind of a falling hazard around here these days. There's so many on our shelves. But we also want to put them in your hands. So please make that pledge call, 217-244-9455.